pleasure to have with us for our first colloquium session this fall, Mr. John Pickard, to give us a talk on the subject of time and aspect in the Greek tenses. John's a graduate here at Biblical, is presently doing some work in the area of computers, getting geared up for further applications in library areas and maybe for further applications in Greek study as well. Computers are getting applied to that area. And he's been spending some time the last couple of years working over aspects of the Greek tenses, and we're happy to have him speak to us this evening on this subject. John.
Thank you. As it said in the paragraph describing my topic this evening, I want to also pay attention to some of the ideas that we can get from linguistics in helping us to analyze various things in the Greek language. As most of you are aware, there is a fair amount of confusion as to the exact meaning of Greek tenses, and particularly this shows up in the aorist tense. In my own studies, I've come across three articles that have directly addressed that problem, one of them by Frank Stagg, which is listed on a bibliography that I passed out on the second page, I believe it is, The Abused Aorist. Recently, Charles Smith from Grace Seminary wrote an article entitled Errant Aorist Interpreters, and on the bottom of page one, there's an article by Randy Maddox on the use of the aorist tense, and also pointing out in that article a number of abuses of the aorist tense. His perspective is that of Methodism, I believe, and often the aorist tense is used to designate, or at least interpreted to mean, a once-for-all kind of sanctification and a perfectionism, and he was pointing out some of the errors that have been suggested in that line. All three of these articles, as I've said, point out errors that have been made and misinterpretations. In my own study, I've come across a number of these, and I believe probably some of you have as well. And so it's been somewhat of a concern to me why this happens. I think part of it is simply because of the differences between English and Greek, and because of that, people with a limited knowledge of the language often make claims and statements that are really not founded on the facts. I also think part of the difficulty is related to an ignorance in regard to the understanding of language in general and the value that can be derived from linguistics and proper forms of analysis. A fair amount of work has been done in this area in the past century especially. And while there is a certain amount of disagreement between linguists, there is a large base on which they would find agreement. And I think we can derive a great deal of help from some of the things they've done. First of all, I'd like to take a little time to define some things. In the title, I talked about time and aspect in Greek tenses. And those three words, time, aspect, and tense, are often used in different ways. During this lecture, I'll be using those terms in this sense. Time meaning relatively past, present, or future. And that may be relative either to the speaker or writer, or perhaps to some other feature in the context. In particular, with participles in Greek, often the time is relative to another verb in the sentence. The term aspect is common today in studies of a linguistic nature, and is pretty much replaced an older term which was quite popular, and that is the term Achtungsart. I'm not sure if I pronounced that right. Someone who knows German could probably correct me. But I use the term aspect in pretty much the same way. It has to do often with the kind of action, although I think that's somewhat of a rough definition as well. In a few minutes, I'll come back to that again. But I think it's important to realize that both when I say time and when I say aspect, we're talking about time relations. And both of those have to do with time. And in this lecture, when I speak of tense, it will include both of those ideas. Sometimes one is dominant, sometimes another, but I don't try to limit tense to the idea of time, as some writers have done. I'd like to put up a little chart here. There we go. What I've tried to do is just give you a basic idea of what is often referred to as time and aspect. And I've just chosen two of the English tenses and what's done with those. For the present tense, the form I see is the common aspect, and the form I am seeing is often called the progressive aspect. And in the past, I saw is the common aspect, and I was seeing is the progressive aspect. We have something similar to this in Greek, which I diagrammed like this. Of course, there are other tenses, but this is just to illustrate the meaning of these terms. Look first at the past tenses of the Greek. The imperfect, which could be designated as the common aspect. The aorist, which could be designated as the common aspect. I have these two forms switched here. You'll have to excuse me. The aorist form should be here, and the imperfect form should be over there. But the aorist is the common aspect, and the imperfect is the progressive aspect. However, in the present tense, there's only one form. And it could be said that that form covers both aspects. And again, I'll come back to that idea again later. But that's just the general idea we're driving at there. What is often confusing to people is the fact that in English, the tenses, in all forms of the tense, you have both aspects with distinct forms. Whereas in the Greek, that's not the case. There are not separate forms distinguishing aspect as opposed to the forms that distinguish tense. And I think this has led to a certain amount of confusion, which I hope to at least have some suggestions on how we can clear that up. A couple of other definitions that I'd like to come across. In terms of grammar, The terms morphology are often used. That's sometimes related to the term morpheme. But morphology has to do with the study of the grammatical structure of words or the forms themselves. Parallel to that is the term syntax, which has to do with the study of grammatical structure of sentences as built up of words. So the distinction there between the forms which make up words and the relationships between the words as they make up sentences. The morpheme could be described as the minimal grammatical unit and is not necessarily a word, but in many cases it amounts to a word. For example, the S, which is added to many nouns in English to indicate the plural, would be a morpheme. It's the smallest unit which has any significance of itself. As I pointed out, I think part of the confusion in regard to tenses relates to the fact of the differences between English and Greek. And because in a language the distinctions in tenses are often very subtle, I'd like to put up some other examples here that you can consider. These are obviously English sentences. Joyce is very cooperative. Joyce is being very cooperative. There, the distinction between the common aspect and the progressive aspect. I believe that most of you, in reading those sentences, would think of number one as meaning a permanent condition, something that Joyce is always. Sounds great. And number two being something that Joyce is doing at the particular time. And that's proper and correct. However, note what happens to those two sentences when another word indicating some time relations is added. For example, Joyce is very cooperative today, all of a sudden takes something that was a very permanent condition and limits it to a particular time. The verb, of course, has not changed at all. And number four, Joyce is being very cooperative this year, takes something that normally would have been somewhat limited in its scope and expands it to cover a longer period of time. Some other examples. Forrest plays chess well, indicates a somewhat permanent condition. Even though it's the common form, the common aspect in English. Boris plays chess on Tuesdays, indicates a repeated type of action. Still, again, the common form. Boris is playing chess normally would mean that at a particular point of time, he's engaged in that activity. However, Boris is playing chess in a tournament could very well mean that it's something that's happening in this general time period, although he isn't necessarily doing it right this moment. He might have a match yesterday and tomorrow, but not today. And finally, Boris is playing chess in a tournament next month. All of a sudden, we're talking about the future. But yet, you'll notice in each of those cases, the verb hasn't changed. Because of those subtle changes, and it's my assertion that they appear in Greek as well, I think a lot of unfortunate statements about the nature of the tenses have been made. Often very wide generalizations which simply can't be applied to many of the individual cases. And then people taking those generalizations and forcing them into cases where they simply don't apply. Now, before you throw in your Greek Testament, I'd like to also encourage you. First of all, it's easier to figure out a construction than to make one. We know English very well, and none of us would have trouble making sentences like this. Fortunately, we don't have to construct the equivalent sentences in Greek. And it is easier to look at a Greek sentence and figure out what it means than to write the sentence. All I'm suggesting is that we need a little more care than has often been exercised in analyzing tenses. What should we do then? As I've said, we need some more refined and accurate classifications. I think one of the most basic things that is done in grammar and the study of language is to make classifications. I think that it's possible to proceed on a somewhat scientific basis. And I would refer you to Gary Harlow's lecture last year or sometime back on the scientific method, where he gives, I think, a good presentation of how that works. Because we're dealing with a limited body of literature, I think it's possible to be very systematic and complete in our analysis. We're talking about New Testament Greek. We, of course, would want to make some reference to other Greek, especially of that same period. But it's possible to approach it in a very systematic and scientific and a complete way. In addition to that, as I've already suggested, I think we ought to draw on some of the insights from linguistic studies and apply those to biblical studies and particularly to biblical hermeneutics. A number of scholars today have made such calls for people to do this, particularly James Barr, who, writing back in the 60s, produced a book entitled The Semantics of... was it? Semantics of Biblical Language. It's on the bibliography there, 1961. Now, James Barr does have some theological views that I think all of us would disagree with, but I think he did us a great service in this work in particular by exposing the fallacies of a particular line of study, and that was the biblical theology movement, in quotes. A movement which it was approaching the Bible in a certain way and coming to some very odd conclusions, many of which would have been against the conservative view of the scriptures.
He also pointed out some of the weaknesses of the Kittel theological word book, and particularly the concept or the importance of distinguishing between a word and a concept, which was not usually made in the articles in that dictionary. A word can have many meanings, and unless it's used as a technical term, should not be substituted for the idea of a theological concept. The writers of the articles for Kittel often saw
or treated the history of a word, thinking that in so doing they were treating a theological concept. And I think because of that, some of the conclusions in the dictionary are invalid. You will find, if you do any further study in this area, that just about everybody uses James Barr as kind of a starting point. It was somewhat of a turning point especially the field of biblical theology and also in general hermeneutics. There are also a number of others who are calling for such analysis. Two of the faculty at Westminster Seminary, Vern Poitras and Moses Silva, have done a fair amount of work in this area. Both of them I have listed on the bibliography. Silva, particularly The Study of Words in Biblical Interpretation. It's a paper of about 40 or 50 pages, a very fine paper on the proper way of studying words. Poitras, a little further up in the bibliography, has an article analyzing a biblical text, some important linguistic distinctions. And both of these men are continuing work in this area. Silva's did both his master's and his doctoral work in that general area. Another scholar is Paul Carlin, who teaches Greek at Philadelphia College of the Bible. Recently completed doctoral work at the University of Pennsylvania. His dissertation, which is listed on the second page of the bibliography, The Syntax of the Participle in the Greek New Testament. And I'd like to quote from his introduction, "The problem that this study is concerned with, then, is the lack of modern treatment of New Testament participles. There has been very little syntactic work in general on the language of the New Testament, and a failure to utilize modern descriptive tools. The grammars are contradictory, not only in terminology, but also in analysis. Exegesis, translation, and instruction will be served by a new treatment." His own approach follows a model of a man named Zelig Harris, who is fairly well known in linguistic circles. But the thing I'd like you to notice is his call for people to become aware of these studies and what can be done. Also, he says the grammars are contradictory, not only in terminology, but also in analysis. That's a very serious charge, I think. And if that is true, you almost say, well, what's the poor pastor to do if he can't trust the grammars? Unfortunately, I think in some cases it is true. I feel there are many places where they do agree, and there's no question about the accuracy of what they state. But in some of the finer points especially, they do disagree, and many of them are wrong. As far as I know, I haven't seen any major advanced-type grammar treating New Testament Greek, which uses a modern linguistic-type approach. There are a few of the basic or beginning grammars that have done so. I think most of you are aware of Getches. I'm also familiar with one by Theodore Muller, entitled New Testament Greek, A Case Grammar Approach. I haven't listed those in the bibliography, but they tend to be beginning grammars. I just like, as long as I'm on the subject, to point out a couple of other titles in the bibliography. The first one, Thistleton, an article on semantics and New Testament interpretation. Very interesting article and informative. I've listed next two general books on introducing linguistics, one by Robbins and one by Gleason. Then, of course, Barr, the next work there by Beekman and Callow, translating the Word of God. If you're just interested in getting some information about this, but yet something that's practical, I would recommend this book. It's designed especially for people who are going to be translating the Bible into languages of other cultures. But there's a tremendous amount of valuable information that can be applied to hermeneutics in general. And particularly their chapter on the genitive construction, I haven't seen anything like it, and I haven't seen anything anywhere as near as valuable. The only thing I wish is that they had treated more constructions. They kind of selected a few things to talk about, but it's not at all what you'd call a grammar in that sense. There are several books by Nida. There's a great deal of value in them. And I pointed out the work by Silva there. The last, next to last work listed, Burton, Ernest DeWitt Burton, Syntax of the Moods and Tenses in New Testament Greek. From my own perspective, I found this to be the most valuable in terms of the verbs of Greek. Unfortunately, that's all he treated. It's not a complete grammar. But I don't think there's anything superior to that. What then would be some general principles that could be applied in interpreting the Bible? I'd like to give you six or seven. I haven't counted exactly how many I have. The first would be the idea that it's important to distinguish the current use of a word or construction from how that word has been used in the past. Sometimes the terms synchronic and diachronic are used in this connection. Synchronic having to do with the study of words at a particular time or relatively small time period. Diachronic referring to the study of words and grammar over a period of time and examining the changes and comparing the language as it changes through time. It should be kept in mind, of course, that the whole concept of a diachronic analysis is impossible without first doing a synchronic analysis. That is, you first have to determine the periods of a language, examine the grammar during those periods, and then compare them between different periods. It's impossible to do the history first. For our perspective of interpreting the New Testament, the historical is of relatively little value. I think it has been overemphasized much too much in grammars and in especially word studies, and Silva points this out as well as others. What you have to realize is that as a language changes, it becomes really a different language. The language which we speak today is not technically the same language as Shakespeare wrote in. And if you try and read Shakespeare, you'll notice many differences. The more time that goes on, the greater the changes are. And it would be improper for us to go back and look at Shakespeare's usages to get ideas on how we ought to interpret writings of our period of time, because there are significant differences. And the same thing is true of Greek. Looking at classical Greek to get an understanding of constructions from Koine Greek is improper. Now, there is a proper use of historical analysis, and that is to compare and note the differences. But sometimes the comparison is made, and the differences aren't clearly noted enough. I think a lot of the grammars have spent a lot of time looking at classical Greek because when some of them were written, a large number of students would have known classical Greek. So they used that as a starting point and tried to point out the differences. However, I think in many cases they've gone beyond that. I'd like to quote from A.T. Robertson, one of the standard grammars, regarding the case system. He says, I agree with B. Green, whom I shall here quote at some length. quote, I shall classify the uses of the cases under the heads of the Arian cases. And he's referring to the original language from which Greek was derived. As in every instance, the true method of explanation of any particular idiom is to trace its connection to the general meaning of the original Arian case. He goes on, to which the case in Latin or Greek corresponds. So he's saying what you have to do is, if you're studying Greek or Latin, you first trace the case you're dealing with back to the language from which it was derived. As most of you know, in some of the earlier languages like Sanskrit and Indo-European, I believe there was actually 8 cases. And that's often the justification for treating Greek as an 8-case system, when in fact, in terms of forms, there are no more than 5. He goes on to say, this method of explanation has the advantage of demanding fewer set terms, while at the same time it requires a logical connection to be made between the particular use in question and the fundamental meaning of the case involved. Again, there, note the terms logical and fundamental meaning. There's problems with trying to fit grammar into logical system. You have to let grammar be what it is in the language itself and not try to figure out the logic behind it. Also, the fundamental meaning of a case as opposed to how it's used in a particular instance. Such an explanation is the better the simpler the words used in it are. And then getting back to Robertson's own statement, this is wonderfully said and has the advantage of being true, which is not always said of grammatical comments. Unfortunately, I disagree with it. It is the method of history, of science, of life. It is a method pursued in the etymology and history of a word. It is the only way to get at the truth about the significance of the Greek cases. That's his statement, and what more can I say than I disagree? Let me quote you an authority who would also disagree with him, and that is Robbins, who I've listed in the bibliography. Page 182 and 183. The two besetting sins of traditional grammar that have hindered and distorted its operations and the development of theoretical consistency have been, number one, the attempts to base grammar and the categories of grammar on alleged types of meaning or on notional, conceptual, or philosophic categories. Okay, he's getting at some sort of universal type of grammar and trying to associate the forms in a particular language with those. That's the first besetting sin. The second besetting sin is the description of a language in terms found suitable or assumed to be suitable for another language, usually one carrying cultural prestige, such as Latin or Sanskrit, or for an earlier stage of the language in question, which for the purposes of grammatical description counts as a separate language also. Okay, two problems he sees in traditional grammar. Trying to have some sort of universal logical system which you relate the grammar to, or trying to use categories from another language on the language that you're analyzing. On the next page, he says, it should be clear from what has been said that the quest for a universal grammar is a vain one. Attempts to devise such a system in the past have rested either on the projection of the grammatical framework of a favored language like Latin onto the analysis of all other languages, irrespective of their actual formal patterns, or on the adoption of a single logical system as supposedly underlying the grammatical organization of every language. Formal grammar must respect the observed patterns of each language separately. And then he continues on, explaining that, in fact, there may be similarities, but it's important to respect each language separately. The point that he makes about the universal grammar is important. Grammar in many ways is simply a matter of convention. What people have come to use and between themselves in some sort of a social agreement as to what certain sounds or symbols on a page will mean and how these will be put together in an organized fashion. to a certain extent, that's simply a convention. And there is no basic universal grammar. Often we don't realize that because we're not familiar with languages that are much different from English. Greek is very, very similar to English if you compared the two of them to, say, some native African language or some native language from the South Seas. But neither can it be said that the Western languages are more complex or better than any of these other languages either. For more discussion of that point, I would recommend some of the books by Nida and also the book by Beekman and Callow that I mentioned before. Okay, so the first point I mentioned was the current use versus the history, and also related to that, the idea of some sort of universal grammar. The second thing that I think is necessary is that a systematic examination of a language is important. It must be comprehensive, and by that I'm especially driving at the point that you don't ignore variations. It's very important that whatever system you use to describe a language, it takes account of all the forms. Often it's not difficult to come up with a classification that covers 70 to 80% of a particular form, and it sounds great. And since you can find plenty of examples to justify it, you can often make others believe that that's the proper classification. But there's then all those variations and exceptions which disprove your point altogether. In a modest attempt to get at this, I tried doing some work on Greek tenses in the Gospel of John, simply by taking the parsing guide, which can be used somewhat like a concordance, going through and tabulating the various uses of particularly the aorist tense, and trying to run through them in groups and get some idea of how they're used. Later on, I hope to make some preliminary suggestions on certain things that I found. Fortunately, there is some help coming on the way. I'm aware of a computer-type project. I believe it's, I don't know if it's actually associated with Grace Seminary or not, but it's a number of people in that area who have entered the text of the New Testament into a database with various tags so that they can search the database and produce essentially a grammatical concordance, a listing of a particular grammatical form, much as we would list particular words as they appear in the New Testament. Also, there is scheduled for publication sometime soon exactly that, a grammatical concordance, which was related to the analytical Greek testament that was published last year. I think both of those can be very helpful in terms of analyzing the language. I had another quote here, but I'm afraid I have misplaced it. Nida, in his work on the syntax, the descriptive analysis, points out the fact that if you examine some of the descriptions of the grammar of certain African languages that were devised by missionaries, it's surprising how similar those languages appear to Latin. Unfortunately, he says, when you examine them a little further, you find out that they really aren't similar to Latin. It's just that the person who had constructed the grammar was familiar with Latin and didn't really recognize the importance of approaching the language on its own merits. He suggests that one of the things they did was to find enough of the constructions which were similar to Latin and ignore everything else. And that's, again, I want to get back to the point of being comprehensive. It's important to take account of all of the variations that appear. Third point, then, is the idea of different senses. I think most of us are aware that a single word can have a number of different meanings or senses, depending on the particular context it appears in. In English, for example, the word run could be used in the following constructions. The boy is running, the water is running, the engine is running, my stocking is running, or has run, if you like. And all of those, I think all we would agree, are the same verb, is running. But yet, each of them has a different sense. It does not mean the same thing in the sentence "the boy is running" as in the sentence "the water is running." Now, there is a common element or a thread of meaning running through all of these, but yet that's not what should not be called the basic meaning of the word. I think it's improper to say that that common thread of meaning is the basic or real meaning of the word. The real meaning is what it means in each particular context. My suggestion is that this also happens with grammatical structures, and it's important to take account of it. I think many of the grammars have passed over this concept and suggested that the real meaning of the aorist tense is its aspect, and that that aspect appears in every form of the aorist tense in the New Testament. I disagree. I think that the aspect is not always important, and I think that in many cases the time is an essential element of the meaning of the tense, particularly in the indicative but also in the participles. It's not always part of the meaning, but that doesn't mean that in those cases where it is part, it's not really there, or it's only a secondary of secondary importance. Related to this is the concept of components of meaning. When you analyze a word, it is possible at times to distinguish various components which together make up the meaning of the word. That also, I think, can be applied to tenses, particularly the two components of time and aspect. For more discussion of that, again, I'd recommend Beekman and Nida's works. The fourth point is that words words by themselves do not have meaning. Because of the fact that most words have more than one sense, it's only when defined in context that a word actually carries meaning. If I were to say to you the word charge, I don't think any one of you could tell me exactly what it is I'm thinking of as I say the word. But if I was to say to you the electron has a negative charge, then all of a sudden the word charge carries a certain kind of meaning. Or if I was to say I have a charge card in my wallet, the meaning is totally different. Now, because of the great differences in those two senses, we would actually distinguish them as two different words. But the important thing that I'm getting at is that by itself that word does not have meaning. It's only when it becomes part of a statement or an utterance or in some sort of context. Ultimately, it's not even just a statement or a sentence which carries the meaning, but the discourse or the complete writing. So what I'm suggesting is that propositions are critical in terms of finding meaning. That idea of propositional meaning is often looked down on, especially in certain liberal circles. But I think it's important for us to recover that, and that the New Testament and the Old Testament were communicated through propositions, that God chose to use the human language and communicate that way. As I said, a sense is a sense of a word. That is, one of the meanings of a word is determined by the context, but yet it is the word that means that. However, at times there's other information that comes from a context which is sometimes ascribed to a word which really doesn't come from the word itself. It comes from the general context that you're approaching. And I think it's important to distinguish that. Distinguish between the sense which is fixed or determined by the context, and determine the other information that comes out of the context in general and not the particular word. Those principles can be applied not just to vocabulary meanings but also to the meanings of grammatical forms. My fifth point is that a suggestion as regarding analysis of verb forms. It's important also to divide constructions into their components. With verbs, this is particularly important because you have a number of different tenses. You have a number of different moods. In addition to the moods, you have the participles and infinitives. You also have voices. You have person and number. And all of those things have an effect on the meaning of the particular verb you're looking at. If you're looking at the meaning of a tense, the changes in voice and person and number I don't think are of great significance. Changes from first to second person really don't affect the meaning of the tense. However, the change from an indicative to a subjunctive does. And the change from an indicative to a participle does. So that an aorist indicative, the aorist has a different meaning in the indicative than it does in the subjunctive and in the participle. I think most people would agree that the aorist indicative is somewhat unique. The aorist participle is somewhat unique. But the aorist subjunctive, imperative, and infinitive have basically the same senses as far as the tense is concerned. In any analysis that's done, especially the kind that you would find in grammar, it's important to make those distinctions. And I don't think they've always been made. You'll find a lot of grammars which will have a discussion of the aorist tense, and they won't really mention the differences between participles and infinitives. Most of them would mention a difference between the indicative, but it's often downplayed. The next point that I would like to make is that in analyzing something, it can be helpful to compare similar constructions where only a minor part has changed. In the English examples I put up before, you'll note that in those examples, just one slight element of the sentence changed. I think if you look at most of the grammars that discuss Greek, you don't see that kind of thing. They'll just run by you different examples that are not at all parallel, and it's sometimes difficult to analyze just what meaning has changed. Is it really the use of the tense that's changed, or is it due to the other words that have changed in the sentence? Again, in my study, I tried to do something of that sort to get a better idea of the exact significance of some tenses. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like I'm going to have time to show you those examples, so I think I'll press on. I gave you a few minutes ago the examples of several sentences in English that were using the verb to run. Each of those sentences had a different subject, and this concept of a single word having certain subjects or objects that can be associated with it is referred to often as collocates. The idea of a certain word collocates with another set of words. Most words have a limited set of collocates that can be associated with them. Okay. The word run, for example, cannot take any noun as its subject. There are only certain nouns that can be put in there as its subject. And that, again, becomes important in defining the meaning of the word run. The final thing that I'd like to say in terms of the general principle is the idea of common sense. It may be that you're feeling somewhat overwhelmed by some of the things I've been saying. I hope not. My own thinking is that common sense will take you a long way. And James Barr has an article entitled exactly that, Common Sense in Biblical Language. And he suggests exactly that, that if you use common sense, you often will not, you normally will not be led astray. He does suggest that there is a place for linguistics in setting up the basis for why common sense, in fact, does work. But most of us have it, and we should use it. And two things in particular I'd like to point out is, number one, don't overanalyze. I think much too much of this has been done. Meaning, as we've said, comes through statements. It doesn't come through individual words or parts of the words. Second thing is, don't do things to Greek that you wouldn't do to English. And again, you see a lot of that kind of thing going on. Greek is a normal language just like English, and if you're analyzing it in ways that you would not analyze English, then you're probably doing something wrong. Okay, I'd like to get down to a few more specifics in regard to the aorist tense. First of all, I'd like to look at some of the statements that are found in grammars, and I hope you'll see that they're not all the same and that they do contradict one another. As I've said before, I believe Burton is the best of the grammars in describing the verbs, and I have very, very little that I disagree with him on. He says on page 16, the constant characteristic of the aorist tense in all of its moods, including the participle, is that it represents the action denoted by it indefinitely. That is, simply as an event, neither on the one hand picturing it as in progress, nor on the other affirming the existence of its result. The name indefinite, as thus understood, is therefore applicable to the tense in all of its uses. I'm not sure I'd be quite so bold as that, but I think by and large we can agree with that. The name indefinite, as thus understood, is applicable to the tense in all of its uses. Let me quote a couple of more statements by him so you get his general picture of the aorist tense. He then divides the aorist into several different senses, although he doesn't use that term, the first of which he calls the historical aorist. The aorist indicative is most frequently used, so the historical aorist, he sees it as the most common. Most frequently used to express a past event viewed in its entirety, simply as an event or a single fact. It has no reference to the progress of the event or to any existing result of it. And under that, he lists three types of events that can be distinguished where the aorist tense is used. A momentary action, an extended act or state, however prolonged in time, if viewed as constituting a single fact without reference to its progress. And the third, a series or aggregate of acts viewed as constituting a single fact. He goes on to point out that those three distinctions don't come from the tense itself. In other words, they're not three senses of the tense, but rather any of those actions or events as they actually happen can be described by an aorist tense. That's very important because some of the other grammars don't make that distinction. The only thing that he does say that I slightly disagree with is he refers to the idea of the writer may or may not have in mind that the act is singular or momentary or extended or a series of acts, but the tense or does not express or suggest the distinction. Later on, he uses the term that the writer is conceiving or viewing, but he's actually referring to what the writer has expressed, and I think a distinction has to be made. He says on page 30, the difference between an historical aorist and an imperfect of action in progress is one not of the nature of the fact, but of the speaker's conception of the fact. It is evidence that the same fact may be expressed by either tense or by both. Note that here they use the word conception, the speaker's conception. I think he's kind of missing the point there. It's not the way a speaker conceives of the act, but of the way he expresses the act.
You'll often see a confusion between the idea of the fact or event as it actually happened. The conception of it and the expression of it. I felt that the grammars are constantly confusing those three ideas, and they must be kept very distinct. And it's really the expression that we're concerned with. We're not concerned with how the writer thought of it, and we're not concerned with how the event actually took place. When you're dealing with written or spoken material, it's the expression and what that expression means that we're looking at. It is sometimes possible to get a more complete idea of the event in our own mind, but yet we really start with the expression, and that's the only thing that can be analyzed. That's Burton, and as I said, I basically find little fault with what he has to say. Blass, De Brunner, and Funk, probably one of the most respected grammars today, has the following to say.
The most important kinds of action, action sarten, what I would refer to as aspect, retained in Greek, including the New Testament, are the following. Number one, the punctiliar, parentheses, momentary, in the aorist stem. The action is conceived of as a point with either the beginning or the end of the action emphasized. Parentheses, ingressive and effective aorist, and he gives an example. Or, and he's still talking about punctiliar, parentheses, momentary, or the action is conceived of as a whole, irrespective of its duration, parentheses, constitutive or complexive aorist, and he gives the example, he made it in the Greek form. And the second type of action, so the first was punctiliar, which he then, in parentheses, defines as momentary. However, later on, he talks about the complexive under that same heading. Number two, the durative, and he gives a slight description of that. Number three, the iterative. Number four, the perfective. And number five, the perfectivizing by means of prepositions. The final statement he makes after the end of that, he comments on the distinction between repeated or durative and point action is still preserved in modern Greek. Frankly, I find that very confusing. He talks about punctiliar, which he then defines as momentary, but yet that same term he applies to the constitutive or complexive aorist. I think all of us are aware of examples from the New Testament, such as the temple was built in 46 years, and aorist tense is used, obviously not a point of time. In Revelation 20, they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Again, obviously not a point of time, but both are aorist tenses again. I'll come back to this concept or this word punctiliar some more. Let me quote Robertson. It says in his heading for the aorist is punctiliar action, and he constantly uses that term. He says, the aorist, as will be shown, is not the only way of expressing indefinite or undefined action, but it is the normal method of doing so. And he goes on to elaborate more. But notice that he's talking about indefinite or undefined and using that as interchangeable with the term punctiliar. I've often been confused by this and found it very frustrating to spend about 2 hours of class time explaining it to beginning Greek students. When, to me, the concept of undefined or indefinite is actually very simple. So I tried looking up in the Webster's Third International Dictionary and found out that indeed punctiliar does mean of or having to do with a point of time. And that's a virtual quote from that dictionary. Since then, it's kind of been a pet peeve of mine, the grammars that use the term. And I believe a great deal of the confusion is related directly to the use of that term by Robertson and by many others who are the standard grammars for the day. Fortunately, Burton did not use the term, but that's not the only reason I liked him. Let me give you some examples of how it is misused. For example, Lenski, in his commentary on Luke, relating to verse 9:23, says this. The verse for your information is, whoever wishes to follow me must deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. And Lenski, at the end of a fairly long discussion, says, the first two imperatives are properly aorist, that is, deny himself, take up his cross. For to deny oneself and to shoulder the cross are momentary acts. Notice he says properly aorist. In other words, he's understanding that the proper sense of the aorist is to designate a momentary act. Lenski is very fond of quoting Robertson, and I believe part of his misunderstanding comes from Robertson's own terminology. And then he goes on, the third is the present, that is, to follow is a long and continuous course of action. The distributive koth hemeron makes the definite taking up of the cross a daily act, which is punctiliar each time. Let me give you some others that are worse.
I found, as it happened, that Max Zurwick's work, Biblical Greek, he happened to have an example of that exact verse. And he says the following in his discussion of the aorist tense. On the other hand, Luke 9:23 has, along with Matthew and Mark, and he refers to the parallels, "If anyone wishes to come after me," and he quotes the Greek, "let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me." Where the aorist can be understood of a definitive self-denial and assumption of the cross once for all, Luke, however, alone adds here to the phrase katemeron, a strange expression in such a context. Note, however, that this edition is very uncertain, for it is lacking in many manuscripts and would be all the more strange in that it is elsewhere in Luke, where it is very frequent, always accompanying the present, as is natural. Perhaps this strange addition of the notion of repetition to the aorist aspect of the verb shows that katemeron was an insertion made after the composition of the rest of the Greek text, or was inserted by Luke himself into the pre-existent text of his source. The point is that he has a total misunderstanding of the significance of the aorist, and that leads to a very gross twisting of the idea of the verse, as well as trying to throw out part of the text. I don't want to get into discussion of the concept of the very words of Jesus, but it's totally unimportant. The fact is, the aorist does not exclude the possibility of a series of repeated acts. And there are so many examples where the aorist is used that his discussion is simply beside the point. Again, one of the highly respected writers on Greek grammar. Another one that I don't have a lot of sympathy for is Moule, idiom book of the Greek New Testament, or of New Testament Greek. He says the following: "To the Greek mind, another consideration appears to have presented itself first, namely the nature of the event." He's giving this in distinction to the considerations of time. And he goes on to use a German word which has become a technical term of grammarians, the Actionsart, or kind of action. "Generally speaking, the first question that the Greek writer seems to ask himself is not, when did or will this happen, but am I conceiving of it as protracted or as virtually instantaneous?" Moulton has represented this pictorially by popularizing the terms linear and punctiliar to denote the two chief contrasted types of action, protracted like a line and focused to a point. He goes on to associate the aorist with what he referred to previously as virtually instantaneous. He also gives an interesting example from the English, where he even confuses the English aspects, but I don't really have time to get into that. But I don't even think he understands English, let alone Greek. I must rush along, but there are a couple of other things I'd just like to point out. As I've said, if you want a good discussion of the significance of the tense, I think you can look at Burton. There are also a couple of articles that I mentioned at the beginning discussing the problems of interpretation, the ones by Stagg and by Smith. Smith sometimes, I think, goes a little too far. Stagg, I have very little that I would disagree with. One thing, however, that Burton does do that I do find some disagreement with is when he's talking about the participle. He says the tenses of the participle, like those of the other dependent moods, do not, in general, in themselves denote time. There's an element of truth there in that it's not essential to the concept, to the tense of the participle to denote a certain time. That is, an aorist participle denoting time prior to some other verb in the sentence. And a number of examples can be found of an aorist participle denoting an action that is either the same action or else an action occurring at the same time as the verb it depends on. Again, I don't have time to get into those, but those examples do exist, so that not every example of an aorist participle refers to a prior time. However, in my study of the Gospel of John, I felt that somewhere in the neighborhood of 125 out of 132 constructions, did denote prior time. And I also, in comparing similar constructions of a present participle and an aorist participle, it appeared to me that the time relation was actually denoted by the participle. It was not derived from some other aspect of the context. So what I'm suggesting is that one of the senses of an aorist participle is to denote prior time, that is, prior to some other element in the sentence. Correspondingly, one of the senses of a present participle is to denote time contemporaneous with another element in the sentence. Many of the grammars really deny that idea, although when it comes back to actually classifying the forms, they often do revert to it. For example, to continue on with the same paragraph in Burton, he says, after saying that the dependent moods, including the participle, do not denote time, he then later says, these distinctions, however, impose certain limitations on the classes of events which may be expressed by the participle of each tense. He's talking about the aspect. Okay, the aspect imposes certain limitations, and thus, indirectly and to a limited extent, the tense of the participle is an indication of the time relation of the event denoted by it. So he kind of backs off from his earlier statement and says that the time does come in. But he qualifies it as much as he can. I wish I could go on and give you some actual examples of Greek that I've seen, but I feel I really need to stop at this point. I would just like to conclude by saying that it may seem very complicated, especially if you're a beginning student, but it's really not as bad as it might seem. As I said before, common sense will take you a long way. Looking at sentences as a whole rather than trying to break up into little pieces and get the exact meaning out of every little part. And if I may be so bold to say it, that we've often paid too much attention to tenses. Tense is a relatively, because it's so common a form, it carries relatively little meaning with it. It is by and large the vocabulary and the constructions, the phrases and the clauses that carry the meaning. And tense by itself has really very little effect on the meaning of a sentence or passage, and is by and large somewhat easy to discern. If you're having trouble, I just suggest getting, I'm not talking about when you're doing your Greek homework, but when you're doing your preparation for a sermon or a study of a passage, compare an English translation. Most of them have been done by very, very competent scholars, and you can hardly go wrong by basing some of your conclusions on suggestions of ways to translate that they have made. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or attacks? Or yes.
One question in your statement. The question is the following. You talk a lot in evangelical circles about verbal seminary inspiration.
Yes.
Should that be modified to more of a contextual inspiration instead of a verbal inspiration?
I think properly understand verbal inspiration is all right. If I understand what you're driving at, a lot of times, you know, because I was saying the meaning is carried by the statement or the utterance, and it is possible to substitute at times another construction which has virtually the same meaning. But I see grave danger in doing that, in saying that only the ideas were inspired or something of that sort. And all I'm suggesting is that God inspired people in a human language, and we need to treat it as a human language, even though it is inspired. And that changing words or sentences of the text based on our own whims would be totally invalid, but yet we shouldn't make too much of the individual words involved anyways.
I think the concept of C.S. Lewis suggested was helpful on this point. I don't know if you believe in verbal inerrancy, but he makes the point of a metaphor or a figure of speech that is chosen by someone who knows what he's talking about, is trying to explain it to someone else. He called that the master's metaphor. versus a student's metaphor who does not know the subject but is trying to describe something. And we might think of verbal inspiration then as being, these are the words which are chosen by the Holy Spirit who knows what he's trying to tell us about. And therefore, if we paraphrase in certain ways, if we properly understand all he's talking about, equally good. But if we don't, we're likely to lose something because it is now the student's metaphor, not the master's metaphor.
Yeah.
And the master's metaphor carries a better fit with the
knowledge. I think that basic idea is the justification for a translation. If we were really concerned about the exact words that were inspired, we'd have to teach everybody who becomes a Christian Greek and Hebrew and Aramaic and never allow any translations. But I do believe translations are valid, and we find that within the Bible itself, translations and interpretations were given. And I don't believe that any translations made are inspired. But yet it is proper to say that what is translated is still the Word of God. I think a couple of papers by Dunsweiler have tried to deal with that sort of topic. Any other?
What I want to say is that if this is frustrating in Greek, it even gets more frustrating in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. It's right in one Latin category to understand the Latin picture.
I gather from Chapman that the more you become familiar with Greek in it, the more you can use your common sense.
I think that's definitely true. I think all of us, when we're listening to an English speaker, don't even have to stop and think about the tenses. They just kind of enter our mind, and we sort of immediately know what's talking about without analyzing. And the better acquainted you become with Greek, I think that will start to happen. I know I have a great deal of difficulty with that. And I find that when I'm analyzing Greek, what I'm really analyzing is my very simple translation of the Greek. And that is exceedingly difficult to get around. I think one of the good ways to do that is, as I said before, look at very similar sentences where only a small element has changed and try and say, well, what has changed in terms of the meaning? And by doing that, we get a better idea. I think one place where that shows up quite commonly, and I had hardly even realized it before, was a substantive present participle. We almost always translate these by progressive verb forms in English. And it's very difficult to look at that translation and say, well, could the time reference be lacking? I'm thinking of probably the most common example, the sower went out to sow, which in Greek is actually a substantive present participle. Often people with limited knowledge of Greek would say, well, that's not a very good translation. You should say the one who is sowing went out to sow. But as a matter of fact, it is a good translation. In that particular usage, the time reference is of very little importance. And the term sower in English very accurately catches the meaning of the Greek. I think there are a number of other examples of that. But that does not mean that in every case the present participle has no time reference. There are other cases where the time reference is very, very important. But getting back to your point, it's... without being very, very familiar with Greek, it's hard to see that distinction because we're looking at a translation all the time. We're never actually thinking in terms of the Greek construction.
I was just wondering, what would be the reason for them to use the method claim and using the aristotelic particle rather than the interior? But they translate it like instead of go.
Yeah.
But instead, it's perfect.
Okay. I would suggest that translation is valid. And it has to do with the influence of the... Which verse is that again? 19? Yeah. You will hear preachers at times say something like, really a better translation is not go and make disciples, rather after you go. I've heard people say that. I don't think that's valid. And I think they're really misunderstanding the Greek idiom again. This is another sense where... there are other examples of participles being closely related to an imperative. I'm familiar with one in Peter, and others probably know of some, where you will find most English translations translate the participle as an imperative.
And all I can say is that's just the idiom. When a participle is so closely related to another verb, it begins to take on some of the force of that verb as well. And that same phenomena, or a similar phenomena, is happening when you have the so-called circumstantial participles. Quite commonly, you'll find translations of a participle and a finite verb in English with two finite verbs. Having turned around, he saw Philip following him, I think is an example. I'd have to look again. But most translations would say he turned around and saw Philip follow him. And that's accurate. That's the way we would say it in English, and the meaning is the same. To say having turned around is not necessary, even though it is a participle in Greek. The idea goes back to the whole idea of words not matching up in meaning in the same thing constructions don't match up. The participle in Greek is much more common than in English. And so some of the things, some of the meanings that would be expressed by the participle in English would be expressed by a finite verb. Other ones are expressed by relative clauses. A very few of them are expressed by a participle in English. And so therefore we shouldn't be afraid of translating them the way we would express them in English. And it's very similar to what you have with words, where, say, for example, one word in a language doesn't match up exactly with a word in another language. A good example is I believe, the language Spanish, where the word, it could be translated as key or faucet. There's another one, too. It is all the same word in Spanish. Okay? We could not translate, in certain contexts, we couldn't translate that word as faucet. I mean, we couldn't translate the word as key in every case. But in some cases, we would have to. In other cases, we'd have to translate it as faucet. And there is, of course, in Spanish, a thread of meaning that runs through all of the senses. In English, we don't have the same grouping of meaning. And that same thing occurs with participles and verb forms. And it's important to recognize that and not think that the same construction has to be transferred over into another language.
Mm-hmm. There's also questions about the past lexicography of the years.
Mm-hmm.
Just the whole matter of that. I've heard in the last year of a book that's been done, the Bible Classic, or I read a guy, two-volume lexicon that's coming out shortly, a Trusted Polonius confidential analysis. I've been asking around that.
No, I don't know. Is anybody else familiar with that? I haven't heard of that myself. I do feel that a fair amount of work can be done, and that certainly would be a worthwhile project. At the same time, I hope no one's getting the idea from this that we should throw all the grammars in the fire or that kind of thing. There's still a great deal of value in them, but they have to be used with discretion, and I think more refined discussions can come up, and that would affect the lexicons as well as the grammars. I think the problem with the lexicons would tend to be simply that they wouldn't give you as much information as you wanted, especially regarding the relationships between synonyms. Very few lexicons really do much in that area, but it's of great importance for understanding the meaning of words. Yeah. Yeah, that sounds good. If anybody's in a rush, you can get it from Westminster too. They've got it in the library, as well as his doctoral. His doctoral work was, I forget the exact title, but it had to do with the interpretation of words with particular reference to the, as he referred to it, the semantic field of mind. And the term field is a technical term in those kind of studies. But
it was including a number of words that have to do with mind and thinking in the New Testament. I believe his work, his doctoral work, was done at under F.F. Bruce, if I'm not mistaken, or at least at that university. The master's was done at Westminster. Any other questions or comments?
Mm-hmm. There's great value in all of it, just reading large blocks to read large blocks.
Absolutely.
In other words, it's really interesting to read it.
Mm-hmm.
That helps greatly in the common sense.
I know not everyone would agree with me, but I would actually recommend an interlinear, which can speed things up a great deal. Or if you're really opposed to interlinears, at least a reading lexicon, which you're not flipping back and forth all the time. Now, for beginning students, again, for Dr. Peterson's students and others, don't do it. But once you've gotten past that, you know, just use these tools and get going. Dr. Cohen required in his exegesis classes that people make up a chart and keep track of all the translating or reading they do. And it can be helpful as a motivator so that you know how far you've gotten. And maybe if you really get into it, you can actually translate the whole New Testament. It's not that big a job. It may seem like it when you're still in first or second year Greek, but just keep working on it. And going back a second time, it gets to be fun when you can go back and you don't have to stop and look up words. I find that's the most discouraging thing in translating. If you can just zip through a chapter in 5 or 10 minutes, man, that's just great. Mm-hmm.